Berkshire Hathaway Inc. February 26, 1982. To the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway Inc. Operating earnings of $39.07 million in 1981 amounted to 15.2% of beginning equity capital valuing securities at cost, compared to 17.8% in 1980. Our new plan that allows stockholders to designate corporate charitable contributions detailed later reduced earnings by about $900,000 in 1981. This program, which we expect to continue subject to annual evaluation of our corporate tax position, had not been initiated in 1980. Non-controlled ownership earnings. In the 1980 annual report, we discussed extensively the concept of non-controlled ownership earnings, i.e. Berkshire's share of the undistributed earnings of companies we don't control or significantly influence, but in which we nevertheless have important investments. We will be glad to make available to new or prospective shareholders copies of that discussion or others from earlier reports to which we refer in this report. No. A portion of those undistributed earnings is included in the operating earnings of Berkshire. However, our belief is that, in aggregate, those undistributed and therefore unrecorded earnings will be translated into tangible value for Berkshire shareholders just as surely as if subsidiaries we control had earned, retained and reported similar earnings. We know that this translation of non-controlled ownership earnings into corresponding realized and unrealized capital gains for Berkshire will be extremely irregular as to time of occurrence. While market values track business values quite well, over long periods, in any given year the relationship can gyrate capriciously. Market recognition of retained earnings also will be unevenly realized among companies. It will be disappointingly low or negative in cases where earnings are employed non-productively and far greater than dollar for dollar of retained earnings in cases of companies that achieve high returns with their augmented capital. Overall, if a group of non-controlled companies is selected with reasonable skill, the group result should be quite satisfactory. In aggregate, our non-controlled business interests have more favorable underlying economic characteristics than our controlled businesses. That's understandable. The area of choice has been far wider. Small portions of exceptionally good businesses are usually available in the securities market at reasonable prices, but such businesses are available for purchase in their entirety only rarely, and then almost always at high prices. General acquisition behavior. As our history indicates, we are comfortable both with total ownership of businesses and with marketable securities representing small portions of businesses. We continually look for ways to employ large sums in each area, but we try to avoid small commitments. If something's not worth doing at all, it's not worth doing well. Indeed, the liquidity requirements of our insurance and trading stamp businesses mandate major investments in marketable securities. Our acquisition decisions will be aimed at maximizing real economic benefits, not at maximizing either managerial domain or reported numbers for accounting purposes. In the long run, management stressing accounting appearance over economic substance usually achieve little of either, regardless of the impact upon immediately reportable earnings. We would rather buy 10% of wonderful business T at X per share than 100% of T at 2X per share. Most corporate managers prefer just the reverse and have no shortage of stated rationales for their behavior. However, we suspect three motivations usually have spoken to be, singly or in combination, the important ones in most high-premium takeovers. One, leaders, business or otherwise, seldom are deficient in animal spirit and often relish increased activity and challenge. At Berkshire, the corporate pulse never beats faster than when an acquisition is in prospect. Two, most organizations, business or otherwise, measure themselves, are measured by others, and compensate their managers far more by the yardstick of size than by any other yardstick. Ask a Fortune 500 manager where his corporation stands on that famous list, and invariably the number responded will be from the list ranked by size of sales. He may well not even know where his corporation places on the list. Fortune just as faithfully compiles ranking the same 500 corporations by profitability. Three, many management apparently were overexposed in impressionable childhood years to the story in which the imprisoned handsome prince is released from a toad's body by a kiss from a beautiful princess. Consequently, they are certain their managerial kiss will do wonders for the profitability of company target. Such optimism is essential. absent that rosy view. Why else should the shareholders of Company Acquisita want to own an interest in T at the 2x takeover cost, rather than at the X market price they would pay if they made direct purchases on their own? In other words, investors can always buy Toads at the going price for Toads. If investors instead bankroll princesses who wish to pay double for the right to kiss the Toad, those kisses had better pack some real dynamite. We've observed many kisses, but very few miracles. Nevertheless, many managerial princesses remain serenely confident about the future potency of their kisses even after their corporate backers are knee-deep in unresponsive Toads. In fairness, we should acknowledge that some acquisition records have been dazzling. Two major categories stand out. The first involves companies that, through design or accident, have purchased only businesses that are particularly well adapted to an inflationary environment. Such favorite business must have two characteristics. One, an ability to increase prices rather easily even when product demand is flat, and capacity is not fully utilized without fear of significant loss of either market share or unit volume, and two, an ability to accommodate large dollar volume increases in business often produce more by inflation and by real growth with only minor additional investment of capital. Managers of ordinary ability, focusing solely on acquisition possibilities meeting these tests, have achieved excellent results in recent decades. However, very few enterprises possess both characteristics, and competition to buy those that do has now become fierce to the point of being self-defeating. The second category involves the managerial superstars, men who can recognize that rare prince who is disguised as a toad, and who have managerial abilities that enable them to peel away the disguise. We salute such managers as Ben Heineman at Northwest Industries, Henry Singleton at Teledyne, Erwin Zabin at National Service Industries, and especially Tom Murphy at Capital Cities Communications, a real managerial twofer whose acquisition efforts have been properly focused in Category 1 and whose operating talents also make him a leader of Category 2. From both direct and vicarious experience, we recognize the difficulty and rarity of these executives' achievements. So do they. These champs have made very few deals in recent years, and often have found a purchase of their own shares to be the most sensible employment of corporate capital. Your chairman, unfortunately, does not qualify for Category 2. And, despite a reasonably good understanding of the economic factors compelling concentration in Category 1, our actual acquisition activity in that category has been sporadic and inadequate. Our preaching was better than our performance. We neglected to know a principle. Predicting rain doesn't count. Building arcs does. We have tried occasionally to buy toads at bargain prices, with results that have been chronicled in past reports. Clearly, our kisses fell flat. We have done well with a couple of princes, but they were princes when purchased. At least our kisses didn't turn them into toads. And, finally, we have occasionally been quite successful in purchasing fractional interests in easily identifiable princes at toad-like prices. Berkshire acquisition objectives. We will continue to seek the acquisition of businesses in their entirety at prices that will make sense, even should the future of the acquired enterprise develop much along the lines of its past. We may very well pay a fairly fancy price for Category 1 business if we are reasonably confident of what we are getting. But we will not normally pay a lot in any purchase for what we are supposed to bring to the party, for we find that we ordinarily don't bring a lot. During 1981, we came quite close to a major purchase involving both a business and a manager we liked very much. However, the price finally demanded, considering alternative uses for the funds involved, would have left our owners worse off than before the purchase. The empire would have been larger, but the citizenry would have been poorer. Although we had no success in 1981, from time to time in the future we will be able to purchase 100% of businesses meeting our standards. Additionally, we expect an occasional offering of a major non-voting partnership as discussed under the Pinkertons, heading on page 47 of this report. We welcome suggestions regarding such companies where we, as a substantial junior partner, can achieve good economic results while furthering the long-term objectives of present owners and managers. Currently, we find values most easily obtained through the open market purchase of fractional positions in companies with excellent business franchises and competent, honest managements. We never expect to run these companies, but we do expect a profit from them. We expect that undistributed earnings from such companies will produce full value subject to tax when realized for Berkshire and its shareholders. If they don't, we have made mistakes as to either 1. The management we have elected to join, 2. The future economics of the business, or 3. The price we have paid. We have made plenty of such mistakes both in the purchase of non-controlling and controlling interests in businesses. Category 2 miscalculations are the most common. Of course, it is necessary to dig deep into our history to find illustrations with such mistakes sometimes as deep as 2 or 3 months back. For example, last year your chairman volunteered his expert opinion on the rosy future of the aluminum business. Several minor adjustments to that opinion, now aggregating approximately 180 degrees, have since been required. For personal as well as more objective reasons, however, we generally have been able to correct such mistakes far more quickly in the case of non-controlled businesses' marketable securities than in the case of controlled subsidiaries. Lack of control, in effect, often has turned out to be an economic plus. As we mentioned last year, the magnitude of our non-recorded ownership greater than our reported operating earnings. We expect this situation will continue. In just 4 ownership positions in this category: Geico Corporation, General Foods Corporation, R.J., Reynolds Industries, Inc., and the Washington Post Company, our share of undistributed and therefore unrecorded earnings probably will total well over $35 million in 1982. The accounting rules that entirely ignore these undistributed earnings diminish the utility of our annual return on equity calculation or any other single year measure of economic performance. Long-term corporate performance. In measuring long-term economic performance, equities held by our insurance subsidiaries are valued at market subject to a charge reflecting the amount of taxes that would have to be paid if unrealized gains were actually realized. If we are correct in the premise stressed in the preceding section of this report, our unreported ownership earnings will find their way irregularly, but inevitably, into our net worth. To date, this has been the case. An even purer calculation of performance would involve a valuation of bonds and non-insurance held equities at market. However, GAAP accounting does not prescribe this procedure, and the added purity would change results only very slightly. Should any valuation difference widen to significant proportions, as it has at most major insurance companies, we will report its effect to you. On a GAAP basis, during the present management's term of 17 years, book value has increased from $19.46 per share to $526.02 per share, or 21.1% compounded annually. This rate of return number is highly likely to drift downward in future years. We hope, however, that it can be maintained significantly above the rate of return achieved by the average large American corporation. Over half of the large gain in Berkshire's net worth during 1981, it totaled $124 million, or about 31%, resulted from the market performance of a single investment, Geico Corporation. In aggregate, our market gain from securities during the year considerably outstripped the gain in underlying business values. Such market variations will not always be on the pleasant side. In past reports, we have explained how inflation has caused our apparently satisfactory long-term corporate performance to be illusory as a measure of true investment results for our owners. We applaud the efforts of Federal Reserve Chairman Volcker and note the currently more moderate increases in various price indices. Nevertheless, our views regarding long-term inflationary trends are as negative as ever. Like virginity, a stable price level seems capable of maintenance, but not of restoration. Despite the overriding importance of inflation in the investment equation, we will not punish you further with another full recital of our views. Inflation itself will be punishment enough. Copies of previous discussions are available for masochists. But because of the unrelenting destruction of currency values, our corporate efforts will continue to do a much better job of filling your wallet than of filling your stomach. Equity value added. An additional factor should further subdue any residual enthusiasm you may retain regarding our long-term rate of return. The economic case justifying equity investment is that, in aggregate, additional earnings above passive investment returns interest on fixed income securities will be derived through the employment of managerial and entrepreneurial skills in conjunction with that equity capital. Furthermore, the case says that since the equity capital position is associated with greater risk than passive forms of investment, it is entitled to higher returns. A value-added bonus from equity capital seems natural and certain. But is it? Several decades back, a return on equity was little as 10% enabled a corporation to be classified as a good business, i.e., one in which a dollar reinvested in the business logically could be expected to be valued by the market at more than 100 cents. Four, with long-term taxable bonds yielding 5% and long-term tax-exempt bonds 3%, a business operation that could utilize equity capital at 10% clearly was worth some premium to investors over the equity capital employed. That was true even though a combination of taxes on dividends and on capital gains would reduce the 10% earned by the corporation to perhaps 6% minus 8% in the hands of the individual investor. Investment markets recognized this truth. During that earlier period, American business earned an average of 11% or so on equity capital employed in stocks in aggregate sold at valuations far above that equity capital book value, averaging over 150 cents on the dollar. Most businesses were good businesses because they earned far more than they keep the return on long-term passive money. The value added produced by equity investment in aggregate was substantial. That day is gone, but the lessons learned during its existence are difficult to discard. While investors and managers must place their feet in the future, their memories and nervous systems often remain plugged into the past. It is much easier for investors to utilize historic P/E ratios or for managers to utilize historic business valuation yardsticks than it is for either group to rethink their premises daily. When change is slow, constant rethinking is actually undesirable. It achieves little and slows response time. But when change is great, yesterday's assumptions can be retained only at great cost. And the pace of economic change has become breathtaking. During the past year, long-term taxable bond yields exceeded 16% and long-term tax exempts 14%. The total return achieved from such tax exempts, of course, goes directly into the pocket of the individual owner. Meanwhile, American businesses producing earnings of only about 14% on equity. And this 14% will be substantially reduced by taxation before it can be banked by the individual owner. The extent of such shrinkage depends upon the dividend policy of the corporation and the tax rates applicable to the investor. Thus, with interest rates on passive investments at late 1981 levels, a typical American business is no longer worth 100 cents on the dollar to owners who are individuals. If the business is owned by pension funds or other tax-exempt investors, the arithmetic, although still unenticing, changes substantially for the better. Assume an investor in a 50% tax bracket. If our typical company pays out all earnings, the income returned to the investor will be equivalent to that from a 7% tax-exempt bond. And if conditions persist, if all earnings are paid out and return on equity stays at 14%, the 7% tax-exempt equivalent to the higher bracket individual investor is just as frozen as is the coupon on a tax-exempt bond. Such a perpetual 7% tax-exempt bond might be worth 50 cents on the dollars. This is written. If, on the other hand, all earnings of our typical American business are retained and return on equity again remains constant, earnings will grow at 14% per year. If the P/E ratio remains constant, the price of our typical stock will also grow at 14% per year. But that 14% is not yet in the pocket of the shareholder. Putting it there will require the payment of a capital gains tax, presently assessed at a maximum rate of 20%. This net return, of course, works out to a poorer rate of return than the currently available passive after-tax rate. Unless passive rates fall, companies achieving 14% per year gains in earnings per share while paying no cash dividend are an economic failure for their individual shareholders. The returns from passive capital outstrip the returns from active capital. This is an unpleasant fact for both investors and corporate managers, and therefore one they may wish to ignore. But facts do not cease to exist, either because they are unpleasant or because they are ignored. Most American businesses pay out a significant portion of their earnings and thus fall between the two examples. And most American businesses are currently bad businesses, economically producing less for their individual investors after tax than the tax-exempt passive rate of return on money. Of course, some high-return businesses still remain attractive, even under present conditions. But American equity capital, in aggregate, produces no value added for individual investors. It should be stressed that this depressing situation does not occur because corporations are jumping economically less high than previously. In fact, they're jumping somewhat higher. Return on equity has improved a few points in the past decade, but the crossbar of passive return has been elevated much faster. Unhappily, most companies can do little but hope that the bar will be lowered significantly. There are a few industries in which the prospects seem bright for substantial gains in return on equity. Inflationary experience and expectations will be major but not the only factors affecting the height of a crossbar in future years. If the causes of long-term inflation can be tempered, passive returns are likely to fall and the intrinsic position of American equity capital should significantly improve. Many businesses that now must be classified as economically bad would be restored to the good category under such circumstances. A further, particularly ironic, punishment is inflicted by an inflationary environment upon the owners of the bad business. To continue operating in its present mode, such a low-return business usually must retain much of its earnings, no matter what penalties such a policy produces for shareholders. Reason, of course, would prescribe just the opposite policy. An individual, stuck with a 5% bond with many years to run before maturity, does not take the coupons from that bond and pay 100 cents on the dollar for more 5% bonds while similar bonds are available at, say, 40 cents on the dollar. Instead, he takes those coupons from his low-return bond and, if inclined to reinvest, looks for the highest return with safety currently available. Good money is not thrown after bad. What makes sense for the bondholder makes sense for the shareholder. Logically, a company with historic and prospective high returns on equity should retain much or all of its earnings so that shareholders can earn premium returns on enhanced capital. Conversely, low returns on corporate equity would suggest a very high dividend payout so that owners could direct capital toward more attractive areas. The scriptures concur. And the parable of the talents, the two high-earning servants are rewarded with 100% retention of earnings and encouraged to expand their operations. However, the non-earning third servant is not only chastised, wicked, and slothful, but also is required to redirect all of his capital to the top performer. Matthew 25, 40-30. But inflation takes us through the looking glass into the upside-down world of Alice in Wonderland. When prices continuously rise, the bad business must retain every nickel that it can. Not because it is attractive as a repository for equity capital, but precisely because it is so unattractive, the low-return business must follow a high-retention policy. If it wishes to continue operating in the future as it is in the past, and most entities, including businesses, do, it simply has no choice. For inflation acts as a gigantic corporate tapeworm. The tapeworm preemptively consumes its requisite daily diet of investment dollars regardless of the health of the host organism. Whatever the level of reported profits, even if nil, more dollars for receivables, inventory and fixed assets are continuously required by the business in order to merely match the unit volume of the previous year. The less prosperous the enterprise, the greater the proportion of available sustenance claimed by the tapeworm. Under present conditions, a business earning 8% or 10% on equity often has no leftovers for expansion, debt production or a real. The tapeworm of inflation simply cleans the plate. The low-return company's inability to pay dividends, understandably, is often disguised. Corporate America increasingly is turning to dividend reinvestment plans, sometimes even embodying a discount arrangement that all but forces shareholders to reinvest. Other companies sell newly issued shares to Peter in order to pay dividends to Paul. Beware of the dividends. Replace the capital distributed. Berkshire continues to retain its earnings for offensive, not defensive or obligatory reasons. But in no way are we immune from the pressures that escalating passive returns exert on equity capital. We continue to clear the crossbar of after-tax passive return, but barely. Our historic 21% return not at all assured for the future still provide after the current capital gain tax rate, which we expect to rise considerably in future years, a modest margin over current after-tax rates on passive money. It would be a bit humiliating to have our corporate value added turn negative, but it can happen here as it has elsewhere, either from events outside anyone's control or from poor relative adaptation on our part. Sources of reported earnings. The table below shows the sources of Berkshire's reported earnings. Berkshire owns about 60% of Blue Chip Stamps, which, in turn, owns 80% of Wesco Financial Corporation. The table displays aggregate operating earnings of the various business entities, as well as Berkshire's share of those earnings. All of the significant gains and losses attributable to unusual sales of assets by any of the business entities are aggregated with securities transactions in a line near the bottom of the table, and are not included in operating earnings. Net earnings. Earnings before income taxes. After tax. Total. Berkshire share. Berkshire share. 1981. 1980. 1981. 1980. 1981. 1980. 0 is omitted operating earnings. Insurance group. Underwriting dollar. 1478. Dollar. 6738. Dollar. 1478. Dollar. 6737. Dollar. 798. Dollar. 3637. Net investment income. 38823. 30939. 38823. 30927. 32401. 25607. Berkshire Warmbick Textiles. 2669. 508. 2669. 508. 1493. 202. Associated retail stores. 1763. 2440. 1763. 2440. 759. 1169. See's Candies. 21891. 15475. 13046. 9223. 6289. 4459. Buffalo Evening News. 1057. 2777. 630. 1655. 276. 800. Blue Chip Stamps Parent. 3642. 7699. 2171. 4588. 2134. 3060. Wesco Financial Parent. 4495. 2916. 2145. 1392. 1590. 1044. Mutual Savings and Loan. 1605. 5814. 766. 2775. 1536. 1974. Precision Steel. 3453. 2833. 1648. 1352. 841. 656. Interest on Debt. 14656. 12230. 12649. 9390. 6671. 4809. Other asterisk. 1895. 1698. 1344. 1308. 1513. 992. Subtotal continuing. Operations dollar 60,663. Dollar 61,037. Dollar 47,236. Dollar 49,189. Dollar 39,421. Dollar 37,191. Illinois National Bank asterisk asterisk. 5,324. 5,200. 4,731. Operating earnings. 60,663. 66,361. 47,236. 54,389. 39,421. 41,922 sales of securities and unusual sales of assets. 37,801. 19,584. 33,115, 15,757, 23,183, 11,200. Total earnings all entities $98,464, $85,945, $80,386, $70,146, $62,604, $53,122. Equals. Asterisk amortization of intangibles arising in accounting for purchases of businesses, i.e., Sees Mutual and Buffalo. Evening News is reflected in the category designated as Asterisk Berkshire divested itself of its ownership of the Illinois National Bank on December 31, 1980. Blue Chip Stamps and Westcote are public companies with reporting requirements of their own. On pages 38-50 of this report, we have reproduced the narrative reports of the principal executives of both companies, in which they describe 1981 operations. A copy of the full annual report of either company will be mailed to any Berkshire shareholder upon request to Mr. Robert H. Bird for Blue Chip Stamps, 5801 Southeastern Avenue, Los Angeles, California 90040, Urcham S.S. Gene Leach for Wesco Financial Corporation, 315 East Colorado Boulevard, Pasadena, California 91109. As we indicated earlier, undistributed earnings in companies we do not control are now fully as important as the reported operating earnings detailed in the preceding table. The distributed portion of earnings, of course, finds its way into the table primarily through the net investment income segment of insurance group earnings. We show below Berkshire's proportional holdings in those non-controlled businesses for which only distributed earnings dividends are included in our earnings. Now, per shares, cost, market. Sears omitted. 451,650. Affiliated Publications, Inc.